Hi guys, it's John. This is the time of year when we remind you about how you can support this podcast by becoming a member of The Incomparable. You can sign up for a monthly or annual pledge to support this podcast directly. Here's what you do. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up. You'll then be asked to pick the shows on the network you'd like to support. If you just check the box for Sophomore Lit, your entire contribution will go to this show after a few fees are taken out. If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, you can also check their boxes, and your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows you want to support. As a thank you for supporting us, members receive a lot of extras. There's exclusive bonus audio, a bootleg podcast where you can hear episodes of shows right after they're recorded without having to wait for the edited version, and a members-only community on Slack. Since this is pledge season, many of the shows on the network will be posting bonus episodes just for members. In the case of Sophomore Lit, we return once again to the trashy bestsellers of yesteryear, with this year's choice being Men Are for Mars, Women Are for Venus. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 per month, and annual equivalents are available as well. And if you're already a member, it's easy to increase your pledge to a higher level and gain some special goodies in return. So if you'd like to support us, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up. And whether you pledge or not, thanks for listening.
Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is my lovely partner, Marina McCoy, my wife, and she's back to discuss another book with us. What book are we doing this time?
We're doing Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Long Winter, which is my favorite amongst the Laura Ingalls Wilder series and one of my favorite childhood books.
As a side note, we read this during not a very long winter, but during some of the bigger snows we had here in Boston this year, so...
Yeah, we didn't have any big snowstorms this year, but in the year of 2015, we had a ton of snow, and I pulled out my copy of The Long Winter because it somehow helped me to process the sheer amount of snow we had in 2015. This has been a very gentle winter here in Boston.
Right. This is the sixth book of the Laura Ingalls Wilder Little House books, which start with Little House in the Big Woods. And they either end with the eighth book, which is the Happy Golden Years, or they end with the ninth book called, what is it?
The First 4 Years.
Right, which was written, Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote a draft, but she never published it in her lifetime. It was published posthumously. So this book does not take place in the woods of Wisconsin. It takes place in a town called DeSmet in the Dakota Territories. I think it's in what's now Minnesota, but there weren't states at the time.
I think it's in what's now North Dakota.
Oh, in North Dakota?
Or
okay.
South Dakota. One of the Dakotas, yeah. Mm-hmm. They did live in Minnesota in some of the earlier books, so.
Right. They went through a lot of stuff between these two books, including, as fans of the TV show will know, Mary, the older sister of Laura, contracted scarlet fever and became blind. And then they, Marina is showing me a helpful map here that shows where they've traveled all through their things. So they went from Wisconsin through Minnesota.
All the way out to Dakota Territory, where they had the tree claim and the homestead. So
yeah, so a lot of things have happened. This book covers the harsh winter of 1880 to 1881. And the only reason I really want to point out that is there's an interesting coincidence here for people like me who studied American studies, which is 1880 was the census where the United States declared that the frontier had closed. And this is why a few years later, Frederick Jackson Turner wrote his essay, The Importance of the Frontier to American History. There's a lot of people who have made careers out of expounding upon Turner's frontier thesis of American culture. But I find it funny that that's supposed to be the year that the frontier closed, because this is a book about some of the harshest life I can imagine in this one of the most remote places that you could be as at least as a European settler in America at that time. You want to talk a little bit about your memories about reading this book as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons it's one of my favorite books is it just shows a story of incredible resilience. I feel like a lot of the earlier Little House books probably were informed by this book. I know there's I remember an account once of how Farmer Boy, which is about Almanzo Wilder's childhood, features a lot of long, long loving descriptions of meals and the feasts they had and the, you know, the economic well-being of the Wilder family. And I don't remember the author, but I remember reading something reflected on the idea that because Laura and her family had faced really close to starvation, that when she went back and wrote a book about her husband's life as a child, that she really understood, you know, she had this sort of like romantic longing for these beautiful meals that in fact she had not really experienced through a good portion of her upbringing. I think, you know, I mean, for me, in some ways, the book was also about the fun of a huge amount of snow coupled with this sort of terrifying idea that you could walk out into the snow and actually die. And I think as a kid, like somehow I minimized this idea that this was actually life-threatening for them, because somehow as a child, you already know that children's books are going to be written in a way that everyone's going to come back okay, and that the story is going to have a positive resolution. And rereading this as an adult, especially this most recent reread, it really struck me how dire their situation really was, that the Treens were not planning to come back to the town and for many months.
So at this point in the Ingalls family history, Pa has a claim shack on the edge of town. This is during the time where people were given homesteads. They were through the Homestead Act. If you could come and you could farm the land, the government would give you this land, which of course was not really the government's to give. Pa had a homestead on the edge of town, and then he had a building in town, right?
Yeah, he had some kind of a store that he owned, and there's a decision made early on in the book that they're going to move into town because he just has a feeling that the winter's going to be bad. I remember being very struck, too, as a child about this description where he talks about he and Laura go over and they see a muskrat home, and Laura's taking on the child's point of view in her narrative of just being fascinated that the muskrats go underwater and they disappear and they go somewhere. And Pa, meanwhile, takes on this adult seriousness to the situation where Pa says, uh-oh, it's going to be a bad winter because look at how thick the walls of the muskrat building are. They know that something's coming. And Pa is sort of presented in this narrative as though he's kind of like the muskrat. He stares at the sky and he says, I know something's coming. We've got to get the hay in. We have to do this. We have to move into town. He just has a feeling. And Carolyn Ma in the story is sort of poo-pooing this idea of intuition and says, there's nothing to worry about. But they follow Pa's gut, and Laura, who always identifies with Pa in these stories, you know, expresses kind of admiration that her dad knew it was important to move back into town.
Yeah, that's a real continuity through these stories. I remember when I was discussing Little House in the Big Woods, we commented then on Pa's mastery of wood lore and the way in which in these books, Pa is presented as belonging to nature because he's able to read the signs in a very strong way. If you actually read accounts of the Ingalls family's life, Pa Wilder went through a lot of failures in his life. He wasn't necessarily that great a farmer, but in these books, he's this towering figure of competence in just the way that he's able to see things that other people aren't able to see.
And he's also this voice of shrewd intelligence in the face of the realities of life on the frontier.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's such a mix of like kind of this hardworking guy who figures out how to like turn hay into sticks and burn them, because otherwise his family will literally like freeze to death. And then this person who like uses his fiddle playing and storytelling, and there's like the always the description of the sparkle in his eyes that somehow keeps the family going emotionally. So whereas I think Laura describes her mother as the person who somehow, you know, provides food on the table and tells them not to complain, occasionally acts gently by telling them they don't have to get out of bed when the house hasn't had the heat turned on it during a blizzard. Pa's the one who kind of provides the emotional upkeep, you might say, of the household. So there's a great passage in the chapter Cold and Dark where Carrie now takes on the role that Laura used to take on when she was a lot younger. And she says, oh, read about the lions in this book that they have, which is a book about the jungle in Africa. Doubtful how accurate it was, the book that he had. But he starts describing this where he says that it's a jungle night in Africa. The flickering light is from our campfire. There are wild animals around us yelling and squealing and roaring, lions, tigers, and hyenas, and I guess a hippopotamus or two. But they won't come anywhere near us because they're afraid of the fire. And then he starts to read. And Laura describes herself as trying to listen, but kind of sliding in and out of reality, dozing in and out of wakefulness and sleep, and the sort of exhaustion that she feels. There's I think it was in the book Prairie Fires by Carolyn Fraser, that she describes that these are basically symptoms of malnutrition, that the family was suffering from malnutrition at this point. And I imagine the parents knew very well their kids, their whole family was literally not getting enough nutrition. And yet Pa kind of plays this role of trying to, help them to reframe their situation by imagining it as this fantastic place very hot Africa.
I recall what you said earlier about realizing this time through that just how perilous their situation was. I had the same experience reading it through this time. I was just trying to keep in track in my head how many days had gone by without them having enough to eat, or how long they had been. When I didn't read this book as a kid, actually, my older brother Rob read all the Little House books and he loved them. He loved this book too. I always got this book confused with The Hard Winter, which is the second book in the Rabbit Hill series.
Well, actually, this book was originally called The Hard Winter.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, and when it was being marketed, The Hard Winter was thought by the publishers at the time to be too tough of a title for kids. They asked them to rename the book The Long Winter.
We read these books together shortly after we met and gotten together.
Because we were 18 and we still thought it was appropriate to read like children's books aloud to each other at that age. So, yeah.
I remember the first time I read through, I didn't actually... All the various blizzards, there's a sequence of blizzards that hit the town in this book, and Laura enumerates them all and says, this one was 3 days, this one was 4 days, or whatever. And if you aren't paying attention, it's very easy for those all to blend together. This time I was trying to add up all the days in my head, and it was shocking to imagine the amount of time these people had to spend indoors without any kind of fresh foods at all. They were basically subsisting on ground wheat that they would grind up in a coffee grinder.
Yeah, it's interesting, the resourcefulness. I mean, I think the thing I liked about this book was the resilience that it displayed. Like for me as a child, just reading about a family that was so resilient certainly put the problems of, kid in the Midwest or whatever into perspective. The family was amazingly resourceful. And you kind of see like a political prudence on the part of Pa Ingalls, because Charles Ingalls notices that Almanzo's house that he's sharing with Royal has walls are the wrong size for the inside versus the outside of the house. And probably also could not have helped notice that they keep feeding him pancakes every time he shows up and say, sit down and have a bunch of pancakes. And they've got to wonder where that grain is coming from. The store is empty. So figures out that they're keeping grain inside the walls of the house that they've built a second layer of walls to kind of contain the grain in. And that's a kind of interesting thing because from a kid's point of view, you think, well, why wouldn't Almanzo just like feed everybody? But from an adult point of view, you can see there was a kind of dilemma. And the dilemma was he would lose his land if he couldn't homestead and grow food on it. And so he decides that if he's gonna keep that seed grain, that he'll go out and search for the grain to feed the town.
Yeah, this is also the book, as you mentioned, that Almanzo and Laura cross paths. We've had these stories about Laura for most of the books. We had the one book about Almanzo's childhood in, I believe, upstate New York. It's a wonderful moment in the book early on when Laura is coming home with her little sister and they take a wrong turn and they go through fields and they get lost and they come across Almanzo lying on top of a mound of hay in a cart. And it's just very theatrical. It's just such a beautiful bit of writing. I hope that this is true, whether it's true or not. I hope this was the way that they met.
You know, it's also interesting that she spends a lot of time talking about Cap Garland.
Yeah.
And so Cap Garland's at the school, and he's the kid who, if you remember in the book, throws her the ball. And because Laura, as she always emphasizes, was never as ladylike as her sister Mary and some of the other girls at school, leaps up to get the ball before she can think and realizes not what the other girls might think well of. But Cap Garland appreciates it. And there is a, so I looked up something about Cap Garland, kind of curious, like what happened to him. And in fact, he did marry Mary Power, who's mentioned in that same chapter by Laura. Laura, when she first started dating Almanzo, thought for a while that she kind of would prefer to go off with Cap. But that didn't happen. And she and Almanzo seem to have had a pretty happy marriage from what I know. Cap, unfortunately, I looked at, after being this true hero for literally along with Almanzo Wilder, saves the town from starvation. I mean, they would have all probably died if this store of grain had not been found. After he marries Mary Power, I think he dies in a boiler explosion in his mid-20s, which is really, really sad to hear about. So that kind of helped me understand, too, that part of her telling this narrative story was a kind of memorializing of him, you know? She's memorializing the fact that this young man that probably no one would ever have known of or heard about after dying in this tragic accident really had a significant role to play in the history of the people who live there.
Early on in the book, Pa is in town at the general store with some other men, and a Native American walks in. There has recently been this controversy surrounding the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award that just recently got renamed because people were worried about the way that Wilder depicts Native Americans in her books. Not a great depiction. A very sort of by the books, racially insensitive depiction of this Native American. But he is given the role of being the soothsayer, the person who's going to try to cross the borders of hostility between the colonizers and the colonized and share with the settlers the news that this winter is going to be terrible. You know, I think Wilder was trying to be kind when she wrote this. It's not great reading today, but...
You know, what it reminded me of is the strangeness of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who, when he talks about in his essay on the origin of inequality, he writes about he's this concept of the natural man, who he also calls savage man, equally insensitive, if not more, much more insensitive than Wilder's conception of what human beings must have been like before civilization. Unfortunately, Rousseau, I think, goes to what Europeans at the time thought of as earlier, more primitive societies that, you know, in his view, led people to be closer somehow to nature than European societies. And I think what Engels is, you know, working out of is something similar to that kind of romanticism that on the one hand is attempting to do better than the Hermas, you know, terribly racist views that all Indians are bad Indians. But I do get the sense that the narrative voice of War in the Long Winter is that this person is worthy of more dignity than the people surrounding are affording him. And so in that sense, I think she was trying to make strides for, you know, her own time.
This is a book that, from what I understand, from what little back reading I did in Prairie Fires and looking things up online, this book is a little closer to sticking to just the facts of what happened to the Engels family during this time, rather than in a lot of Wilder's books, incidents get compressed, combined for narrative effect, and things get elided. But there is one major elision in this book, which is the fact that when the Engels went goat to Smet early on in the winter, realizing that it's going to be a terrible winter, shortly after Pa finds his cattle frozen to the ground, literally frozen as they're trying to eat the grass. When they, in actual life, there was another young family living with them in the house, a man and a woman whom Ma Engels helped deliver their baby. And it's interesting that they're left out of this book. I think in Prairie Fires, it said that Pa did not get along well with the young man, and maybe Laura just didn't want to insert this kind of interpersonal drama into what was already kind of a fraught situation. What were your favorite parts of this book? What sticks with you over all these years?
Good question. I mean, I think one of the passages I really remember thinking about was when they come back from school and they almost miss the town. So there's a scene where there's a terrible blizzard that starts up, and the new school teacher in town might have been actually, is it Alonzo Wilder's sister at that point, Eliza? But whoever the new school teacher is had just sort of arrived, and they didn't kind of know what to do when a blizzard hit. They just knew that their schoolhouse was, you know, far enough out of town. There's no, you know, clear road to follow or anything like that. The blizzard comes, and Laura starts thinking and calculating in her head, like, if this blizzard lasts this many days, here's how long the furniture will last to keep us alive if we have to cut it up and burn it. And she starts to realize very quickly it's a good idea for them to go back, but she also doesn't want to be disobedient to authority. And then suddenly neighbor breaks in and says, I'm coming to get you and take you back to town. And they, as they're walking back to town, they come really, really close to almost missing the town altogether. And Laura just barely like bumps into a building and starts screaming through the wind at everybody. You know, I hit a building. And she reflects on the fact that had she not hit that building, they would have wandered out into the prairie and all died. So I guess I liked a lot of high drama as a kid, but I did, I guess there was something about the like grace or the gift of life or something like that, the sense that, you know, these very small things in our lives can make such a big difference. And just that, I think for me, maybe being like a young philosopher already, you know, like it's my profession as a philosopher, I just noticed that, wow, there's this, a single moment makes all the difference in human life. And that single moment went well for her. And all kinds of things change as a result. I think I also really loved just as a kid, like when the Christmas barrel finally comes and they have this Christmas barrel they've been waiting for, like since really before Thanksgiving, and it finally comes through on the railroad and there's still a turkey in there and they have Christmas dinner late. And I think I was even more impressed by the fact that when they have their actual Christmas, there's no gifts, but they figure out a way to give gifts to one another. So again, that sense, there's a sense in the Engels family that no matter what else is going on around us, we will find a way to make Christmas Christmas. And so, you know, Laura's embroidering something that was for herself, but she ends up finding a card to put in this embroidered frame and give it to Gary. And everybody finds something to make in order to make sure that Christmas actually happens. But that, you know, but then that idea that somehow the Christmas barrel finally comes is this sort of like this unexpected grace, this unexpected gift. So I think there's a lot in this book about looking for the gifts, even in the hardest of times, and the way in which Laura was both like doggedly realistic, calculating how long the school benches were going to last if they were stuck in the schoolhouse during a 3-day blizzard, but also this way in which her family really taught her to always try to find the good in any situation and to kind of cling to that.
My favorite passage from the book was fairly early on in the book, shortly after one of the early blizzards. They discover this flightless water bird, and Laura thinks that it looks like a baby giant auk. Yeah. And it's such a strange passage because, of course, we don't know what the bird was. We can't know what the bird was. We know what Laura thought it was. And we know that Pa confirms that it's some sort of a water bird. If it weren't a giant auk, I don't know what else it would be in the Northern Hemisphere. Maybe a puffin. But it's very strange. And one of the things I love about it is in the illustration by Garth Williams, where they set the bird free, finally, it's just this little blur of a creature because, of course, Williams mm-hmm. has no idea what this bird is. Mm-hmm. And it sort of reminded me in a weird way of like a story by Edward Gorey, like the uninvited guest, that there's this strange creature that's just there for a while and we never know what happens to it in the end. There's something about that that encapsulates sort of the unknowability of nature, the sort of the vastness of life in the prairie. Mm-hmm. Both of us grew up in the Midwest, and it was fairly settled by the time we came along. But I still lived on the edge of a town where I was close to a lot of fields. And sometimes I would wander off into the fields, and it felt like going off the end of the world because you could walk for miles and miles without seeing another person. So that I love that passage.
It's interesting because it reminded me of an article I had read in Boston Globe or on CBS Boston that said, I'm talking about this bird blown off course by Hurricane Jose that had never before been seen in Massachusetts. And essentially, there was a tropical bird found by and given to the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in Easton, Massachusetts. It's called a masked booby found at a Cape Cod beach. They'd never seen one before on the state's soil. They tend to be found in the Gulf of Mexico. And it came up, it's absolutely adorable. It's this very long-beaked creature that was found in Cape Cod after the hurricane. So it can happen that birds get blown off course. That's the kind of detail, right, that you might read as if you didn't know this about birds and think, well, they should know what the bird was, right? That couldn't really have happened, or the blizzard could not have brought in a bird from that far away.
And this last year, we had the mandarin duck in Central Park.
Yeah, right. The sexy duck. Yeah. The duck that all the other ducks envy.
Right. One thing that struck me very much reading through this time was in past books, I always thought that Pa was kind of funny in his dislike of people and civilization, because it seemed like every book would start with Pa saying, oh no, people have moved in 5 miles away. It's time for us to move out even further west.
Yeah, there's 50 people here now. We got to get going.
Right.
And Carolyn's always like, no, there's a school here. I'm tired of homeschooling.
Right. But this book keeps playing back and forth with the advantages and disadvantages of communal life. The Ingalls go into town because they feel like that's really the only safe thing to do, is to be where there's other people. But Ma is, of all people, is distrustful of that. She doesn't like the idea of leaving their shack unattended. She also feels like the other people are just going to be a burden when they're there, and maybe they'll just be carrying the weight of other people around them. And it goes back and forth in this book. There's people who rise to the occasion and do marvelous things, like Cap and Almanzo, who set off in yet another blizzard in search of this store of grain that may or may not exist, and eventually end up saving the town at great risk to themselves. But then there's also a lot of there's infighting, there's profiteering. There's a sequence where once Almanzo and Cap bring the grain back to the storekeeper in town, he wants to sell it to gouge prices, and it almost feels like there's going to be a riot that Pa sort of talks people down from, again, being...
Yeah, I think there was something about that in Prairie Fires. Maybe you told me that there was going to be maybe almost a riot, and that, Pa does sort of talk people down and says something to the effect of, it's interesting, Laura still frames it as an author within the basic framework of everyone's making free choices for themselves, but obviously the free choice of the businessman is a terrible one for the town. And the way that gets framed is that Pa reasons with him and says, well, you can sell the grain. You have the right to sell the grain for whatever price you want to. But then we're never going to buy anything from you again. And your store is going to go out of business in the future. So it's kind of interesting because there's not like a strong ethical argument being made that it is right for you to sell it at a lower price. It's the tactic, it's sort of the argumentative tactic is really different that gets taken out. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and the closest this book has to a villain is the railroad company, which basically gives up on trying to get any kind of provisions to DeSmet after a couple of bad experiences where an incompetent engineer tries to plow through a drift of snow and then ends up stuck. And finally they say, okay, that's it. We're not going to even try until spring comes, which basically condemns the town of DeSmet to 2 to 3 months without any kind of food.
It's absolutely extraordinary. I was saying to John as we're sitting around the house reading this in preparation for the podcast, we live in Boston on a, moderately populated street, not a highly dense urban area, but pretty dense neighborhood compared to certainly... any kind of small town in the Midwest, and imagining that, like, what if only our street was all that was left of the town, and it was cut off from anywhere else, and that was it, like, whatever we all had in our houses. And then suddenly, Pa comes home and says to the family, well, the trains are not going to run till spring. And Ma's cheerful response to this is, well, next month is February. And it's January. And then March will be spring. And as we all know, living anywhere north of Virginia, March isn't really very spring-like, very many places. We had snow only a few days ago here in Boston at the end of March, and it'll be probably warm this weekend. But it's not uncommon for serious storms to continue through March and even into April. So this idea that Ma's putting on a happy face, but she's clearly knows this is a dire situation when the trains have announced that they're not going to give them any more resources after mid-January until the thaw comes.
Yeah.
It's an
interesting situation because the only reason that they know what's going on with the trains is they have a telegraph line in, and that's a kind of a fascinating thing too, is to think about that slight moment in time there where people had telegraph lines and they could communicate instantaneously for the first time with other cities, but they couldn't travel to them at all. So it didn't necessarily do them any good other than confirm that they weren't going to be getting any trains anytime soon. But back to the point about civilization. In some ways, civilization has failed the town of DeSmet, but still all they have is each other. All they have is each other to rely upon and to hold each other up. So it's a complicated story about what people owe to each other. As you say, Pa frames his argument out of self-interest, but we as readers can't help but see this as something of an ethical dilemma.
Yeah, I mean, the overwhelming moral principle behind the book from the point of view of the author is God helps those who help themselves or something, like this idea that you're supposed to take care of yourself, be as resourceful as you can. But there's certainly no romantic vision that means everything will turn out okay. So it's not this vision that as long as you are self-sufficient and take care of yourself and work hard every day, everything will be fine. It's something more like life is really, really hard. And given that it's so hard, you better not depend upon other people because they might fail you like those train people did. And therefore, the most important thing is to use all the resources you have. And those resources actually include social resources for them. You know, not only the social resources within the family unit, but the social resources that Pa had built up through his relationships with people like Almanzo and the way that Almanzo and Royal go out to the sky. You know, it's kind of interesting. That's a bit of a segue here, or, move to a different topic. But Almanzo refuses to sell his seed because he absolutely has to be able to homestead that year. But the argument that he gives when he goes out to the person who's keeping all the seed is, yeah, you want to plant your seed to keep your homestead, but you know, you can probably make that money back easy next year. So he gives an argument that is completely contrary to his own reasons for keeping the seed wheat for himself. But, you know, that's part of Almanzo and Royal's and Cap's resourcefulness, is this way in which they sort of think about the social landscape around them and find ways to reason with people and make arguments to help them get what they need and help the other people in town get what they need.
I love your point about how the message of this book ultimately is about developing self-reliance, because that, of course, ties back into the Turner thesis about the frontiers. That's the sort of one of the defining characteristics of the American characters, this ideal of self-reliance, even in the face of the fact that people, even settlers, are actually benefiting from the fact that they are being gifted land by their government that would not be possible in, say, Europe, where all the land has long since passed into ownership. One of the things that ties the whole book together are these songs that Pa sings. Mm. And throughout this book, mostly Pa has been singing a Scottish song. It's actually by Sir Walter Scott. It's sort of a march, and it's sort of like a cry to keep your spirits up. But then at the very end of the book, he sings what he says is a new song, a song that he just learned recently called What's the Use of Repining? You can actually go to YouTube and look up What's the Use of Repining. You can find a wonderful set of recordings of this charming and in some ways a little bit silly song about how hard life is, but it doesn't do you any good to complain about that. The recording I heard was from an album of old Mormon hymns. It was at least at one point associated with the Mormon church and seen as a hymn, but it's more like a bit of like folk wisdom.
Yeah. One of the other songs they sing is, they sang Ma's favorite, There's a Happy Land Far, Far Away. And other hymn tunes like Jesus is a Rock in a Weary Land, a Weary Land, a Weary Land, a Shelter in this Time of Storm. Something that's interesting is when in the later book, Laura meets Almanzo and they sing together. One of the things that they seem to do on the sleigh rides together is they sing songs that kind of fit the moment, you know, so they'll like figure out a song that goes with whatever's happening around them. And it seems like that was something that Laura had grown up with her Pa.
Right. Well, that's part of self-reliance, making your own culture.
Well, yeah. Or at least taking the culture you've been given and then bringing it apropos to the situation and making it your own.
No matter how far away they get from civilization, they have this link by literature. The song that Pa sings is Sir Walter Scott. In the earlier book, Little House in the Big Woods, they were very excited to have gotten a book of Longfellow's poems.
And they have a Bible verse competition.
Right.
That would have made your grandparents cox proud. which is, and I don't mean that in a mocking way, but just like in a, you know, in the sense that like, that's just not something people do anymore, at least in the United States. But there certainly is a way in which there was this competition to try to remember as many Bible verses they had memorized as they could. So yeah, I think because books are expensive and hard to come by and they only have a few books in their house, that there's a real sense that like the memorization of books and retaining that as part of your oral history is an important part of being educated.
Any final words you want to have before we shut this down?
There's a happy land far, far away.
Thanks again to my co-host, Marina. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join the Facebook page, or if you're an Incomparable member, look for us on the Incomparable membership Slack. Keep up the reading, everyone, because everything will be on the final.